What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation.
Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. With the rapid growth of electronically stored information in litigation, one of the biggest e-discovery challenges is to find new ways to store that information efficiently and cost-effectively, at the same time not limiting access throughout the discovery process, which can sometimes linger on for months or even years. Many organizations, in comparing e-discovery technologies, are making data storage options and hosting cost flexibility a top priority. Here today to discuss data storage costs and a capability known as nearlining are Brian Calla and Andrea Gibson. Brian Calla is a member at Eckert Siemens in Pittsburgh. He concentrates his practice in the general civil litigation with a particular emphasis on e-discovery, mass tort litigation, and products liability. Andrea Gibson is the director of product for Discovery Solutions at Kroll On Track, specifically working on the ediscovery.com review product line. She has more than 10 years of direct experience as a litigator and legal consultant, and she is based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Brian and Andrea, great to have you on the ESI Report today.
Glad to be here, Michelle.
Thanks for having us, Michelle.
So, Andrea, let's go ahead and jump right in with this whole conversation around storage costs in e-discovery platforms. Why don't you set the stage for our listeners? You work closely with e-discovery professionals and clients of Kroll On Track to help them provide the best tool for them in regards to efficiency of review and costs associated with the review process. What are some of the greatest challenges that you see, specifically with regards to data storage and access and costs?
Good question, Michelle. Breaking it down between data storage itself and then the cost, I think the first item would be to remember that data access doesn't mean all data, but it does mean the appropriate data for any point in time. And of course, what's appropriate in a matter today may not be what's appropriate or needed in 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, or a year from now, because things change throughout the life of an investigation or a regulatory review or litigation, of course. And that requires both the legal team as well as the technology they choose to be dynamic, flexible, and fast. And that grouping of qualities is sometimes difficult to find, and oftentimes people don't think ahead to know that they need to be prepared to change. So that's one item. The second goes directly to the issue of storage itself. And one of the basic tenets of e-discovery is that volume equals money. The more gigabytes, terabytes, petabytes, perhaps, that you have to use, it costs more. The more volume, the more money. So reducing that volume footprint while still providing that full and appropriate data set, it's not only becoming more and more critical for the market, but it's even becoming foundational here at Kroll On Track in terms of the technology solutions that we're offering. So number one, making sure that you have all of your appropriate data at any point in time. And number two, being mindful that you need to reduce your volume footprint while keeping that appropriate data set available to you.
So, Brian, working on the other end of this relationship from a law firm perspective, what are some things that law firms are looking at to resolve these issues with storage of data, data volumes, and costs of discovery databases to really reduce the overall discovery costs?
Well, I think the overall discovery cost is something that's certainly always on the top of the mind of our clients. And if you can be proactive to advise them to limit the amount of material that gets collected when the time comes for a document collection, whether it's by using a date restriction or search terms to restrict things, or being very conscious of the right custodians to collect from, those are all things that obviously you can do on the front end to limit the cost and your data footprint and what you collect. But a lot of times that doesn't happen. I get involved many times where the clients are just chomping at the bit to get started, and they want to move immediately before they have everything thought out, before they have search terms agreed upon with the other side, before they really have a firm idea of what they want the date restriction to be. So then you end up collecting a lot of material that maybe you wouldn't if you had thought all these things out ahead of time, and you push them all to a database for review, which gets a little expensive. But there are definitely vendors out there like Kroll where you can get a portfolio agreement, which is something that we take advantage of. We can basically process as much material as we want, and then we push whatever, we'll take a hit on search terms or within the relevant date range to the review tool. And from that point on, we can take it even further. It's a nice feature to be able to use predictive coding when you're doing early case assessment so that you can narrow down, what is in the review tool from that point. And after you narrow it down in the system, like Kroll's, where we've got the opportunity to nearline, then we nearline all that material that that we have basically weeded out using predictive coding. So that's kind of like, I guess, a more kind of real life example that seems to happen to me quite a bit lately, in that we can use a lot of early case assessment and then nearlining the material that we don't want to review, which saves the client quite a bit of money.
Sounds really interesting. Andrea, perhaps you can expand upon the nearlining feature within eDiscovery.com review. Explain to us how this innovation is being used to reduce the overall storage cost volume.
Will do. So nearlining is a way within eDiscovery.com review to reduce your active volume footprint by setting aside, at a radically reduced storage cost, data that you either don't need at all or that you don't need at this moment in time. Whenever you send data from active to nearline, we automatically preserve all work product associated with every single file. And if or when you need to retrieve any data that you have sent to nearline, it's very simple and fast to do so. In fact, both sending and retrieving data from Nearline is done with the simple right click of a mouse. There's no behind-the-scenes heroics needed by any of our client services or engineering teams. The client has full and immediate control of their active and Nearline volume. As a matter of pride, I think it's important to note that you can send, by you I mean our clients, again with a simple click of a mouse, you can send 100,000 files from active storage to nearline storage in 35 seconds. After they have been sent to nearline storage, they no longer clutter your searches or your predictive coding in the active portion of your database, keeping it nimble and appropriate for what matters at that point in time. When you do decide that you need to retrieve some or all of the data in Nearline, it does take a little bit longer to bring it back because we need to rebuild the indices, making sure that the data will once again be available for searching and predictive coding. So whereas you can send data away, so 100,000 files in 35 seconds, it will take somewhere between 3 and 8 minutes to retrieve that same number of files, again, because we do need to rebuild the indices. Nearlining has been very, very, very well received by our clients and within the market because it gives that database control, pure focus on what's really important in your active database, and the flexibility to go back and forth between active and nearline for what matters at that point in time for our clients.
And Brian, you mentioned it a little bit that you're using this nearlining feature to send things off that you might not need, for example, things that are non-hits or not relevant, and send that off to nearlining. Are your teams using it as Andrea describes? And perhaps give us a little bit of a mini case study with regards to sending things from active to nearline and bringing it back. And are you seeing sort of that ease and control with regards to moving the data around?
Yeah, like I mentioned before, one way that we often use it is kind of after doing some early case assessment and then nearlining material that we know that we don't want to review. Another thing that we do is when a project is finished, when a review is finished, obviously people still need access to data for the next steps, whether it's depot prep or, you know, interviewing witnesses or whatever. So we'll nearline the documents that were coded not responsive and then leave active the documents that we produced. So that makes our active data footprint smaller. We sometimes, you know, you'll collect custodians and realize that maybe they aren't as important as people initially thought at the beginning of the litigation, and we've nearlined entire custodians because we just decided that we didn't need to review their material. We've had instances where we, like I mentioned earlier, maybe the search terms and date restrictions were created early on before a lot of information was gathered or before they agreed to the search terms with opposing counsel. And then after they get the agreement, they realize that maybe we can remove some of the search terms or the date restriction gets changed. So, you know, in the middle of a review, we can find the documents that are outside the new date restriction and nearline those. And it's nice because, you know, if something changes, again, you know, you can just go in and, like Andrea said, with a right click a button and bring that material back if you change your mind, which is a really nice feature. So, I mean, to give an example, it's you know, when a project's finished, we had recently had a project where we reviewed about 250 gigabytes of material, and we reviewed everything, made our productions, and at the end, there was about 50 gigabytes that ended up being produced. So we nearlined the 200 gigabytes and kept the 50 gigabytes active, so people still had access to it.
Certainly sounds like an innovative way of conducting review. Andrea, talk to us a little bit more, other than nearlining, what about the format of the data as it's stored within a review database? How are you seeing tools develop with regards to TIFF images, text files, native files, all of those important components that we place in document review platforms? Are all those formats needed throughout the entire life cycle of a review, and what can you do to help reconsider some of those formats to, again, reduce storage costs?
As proof positive that I did, in fact, go to law school, graduate, and am a member in good standing of the bar, Michelle, the only appropriate answer I can give you is it depends. So with document formats, the data that we receive from our clients is typically in native form, as stored on either the servers, the hard drives, flash drives, tapes of a corporate entity or a business or sometimes even an individual. That native data then needs to be processed and converted to a reviewable, useful source. So that means that you'll have the native, you'll have metadata, which is information or data about the data, You'll have extracted text from the native files that's used for searching and usually for predictive coding. And then especially for those files that will need to be shared with opposing counsel or co-counsel or experts, you'll also need to have some kind of image of each file, a PDF, a TIFF image, something like that. With each of those formats, the volume or potential volume of a file increases, and it's pretty significant. If you were to consider a file's potential volume and give it 100%, 3% of that file's potential volume is the text and metadata. Roughly 28 or 29 cents of that file's potential volume would be the native, and then typically around 69 cents or 69% of that file's potential volume would be the image. So if there's a way to get full utility of a file by reducing the amount of formats available for that file, it really does provide tremendous, perhaps even radical, cost savings while, again, still preserving the utility. What we've done with eDiscovery.com Review is make formatted text the default for all data uploaded to the application. And by formatted text, I mean that Word documents and emails and text documents, most documents, in fact, look almost exactly alike between the formatted text format as it would in either the native or the image. So for the vast majority of files within each of our databases, you can capably review with the text alone, keeping your volume footprint to a minimal, 3% of the file's potential volume. There are, of course, exceptions. The easiest exceptions to think about would be Excel files or PowerPoints, images, audio recordings, things that typically the native and sometimes the image format are going to be critical. You wouldn't necessarily want to get the native or the image for all of these file types, only those that you think may be potentially useful. So by using searching or predictive coding or other analytical tools within the application, you're able to more carefully target which files to request, the native or the image or both. And again, just as with nearlining, all of that's done with a simple right click of the mouse. The other thing that's really important to note, in addition to certain file types like Excel and PowerPoint, where more than the formatted text may be required, are those files where there's hidden content. This would be track changes, perhaps in an Excel file where you have hidden rows, hidden worksheets, things like that. What we've done in Review is tell the user automatically when hidden content exists. So it's very easy to group all of those files together and then with a simple right click, pull in the native and the image for those files. And typically what we found is roughly 3% of all Review databases include hidden content. So by getting the native and the image for all hidden content files, it still keeps your costs really, really, really low as compared to having native and or image for everything. So for the market at large, I see a lot more attention coming on the horizon to document formats, and I'm happy to say that we already provide that flexibility for our clients today.
Brian, perhaps you could wrap up with a little bit of discussion about some of the other innovative things that you're doing with your clients' document reviews at your firm to control document review costs and drive additional efficiencies. We talked a little bit about the nearlining and what you're doing there. Andrea talked about the storage formats. Are there other things on the horizon that you see really as critical innovations that you're leveraging?
Ones that we're leveraging, I think, hopefully is one that most people are leveraging now, is predictive coding. We use, or TAR, or whatever you want to call it, we use that every opportunity that we get. And not just for using it on a the actual review for production, but as I mentioned earlier, for early case assessment, we'll also use it for productions that are made to us so that we can more efficiently go through productions that are sent to us from opposing. We have another time that we use it, we'll use it for QC quite a bit. It's interesting to look at documents that the machine thinks should be responsive, but we coded them not responsive to see if we've, you know, missed anything. And one other thing that we do is we use it when, even if we're not using it for the true sense of finding the responsive documents and then taking a sample of the remainder that the machine thinks are not responsive and stopping the review. If we have clients that want to use predictive coding, or they want basically a straight linear review and want eyes on every document, we'll still use predictive coding to tailor the workflow so that the more likely responsive documents get pushed to the front of the review. And that certainly adds a lot of efficiency to our review. And also, you know, you get the benefit of it will group like documents together so that, you know, you have email strings or similar emails, you know, all in a row in your review set. And, you know, once you see the first one, you buzz through the next five because they're very similar to that first email that you saw. That's a big help, too. So, I mean, you can use predictive just using it for the workflow itself. We have had a lot of success with that. So I think that kind of in the future, I think more use of predictive coding, certainly as more and more people get comfortable with it. We have clients. The clients aren't comfortable with it, which is kind of surprising because it's such a huge money saver. But the more people that get on board, the more comfortable they feel with it. You know, I think that's definitely still an area for growth and an area where people can, you know, definitely use to limit the cost of a review. I mean, since what, 70% of the cost of document production is the review, that's where you're going to get a big bang for your buck. Other things that, you know, some vendors have that I've seen that is helpful, I think, like we do a lot of pharma defense work, so we've do quite a bit of redactions on either other similar drugs that the companies we work for have, but they aren't subject to litigation, so we do a lot of redactions about their financial information and on, you know, spreadsheets when a whole group of medications are all marketed together, or at least for financial planning purposes, they're looked at as a group and not as just, you know, one specific drug. We'll redact a lot of material from that. We redact a lot of patient identifying information. So a big time saver is if you've got a tool that will allow you to make redactions, it'll automatically redact anything that looks like it's in a Social Security number format, or redactions where you can pick redactions that you want to make and actually tell it what you don't want to redact, and then the machine automatically redacts everything on the page. You just tell it, if you've got like one line of a spreadsheet that you want to keep, you tell it, I want to keep this one line, and everything else is automatically redacted. So I think like anything that automates the process are things that people are going to embrace and add to their tools and basically add to their toolbox of things that they can offer to clients to help save them money, because you want to be as efficient as you possibly can.
And that sums it up perfectly, Brian. I think we'll wrap it right there. There's no better place to stop. Brian Calla from Eckert Siemens, Andrea Gibson from Kroll OnTrack, thank you for joining me on the ESI Report today.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Michelle. Absolute pleasure to be here today.
So that wraps up another edition of the ESI Report. Thank you to everyone listening, and thanks to Kroll OnTrack for sponsoring the show. If you want to make sure you're in the eDiscovery know, make sure you follow all the eDiscovery news at eDiscovery.com.
Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track. Be sure to follow Kroll On Track on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll On Track's software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.